Welcome to the Parables of the Master podcast.
In this episode, we will explore the seventh parable of the Master, the Rich Fool. This parable teaches us about greed, the inclination to want even more irrespective of how much we already have or how much we've already been blessed with. We shall attempt to clarify that greed pertains to much more than the unquenchable desire of having more money. Our studies of the parables thus far have led us to the understanding that it's our inner light of attention that is responsible for revealing the truth to us. However, this is only possible when the power of attention is directed within and there's absolute honesty about what is shown. The same fundamental process is used throughout our spiritual journey. The more we use this process, the more it serves to amplify the intensity of the light, thus illuminating and revealing even more truth to the seeker. It is evident that greed also plays a role in this process, for the more we know, the more we want to know. The brighter we shine, the brighter still we aspire to shine. Thus, the inner light of revelation is also responsible for illuminating the facility of desire itself. We can evolve to a level of understanding so profound that we can question what it actually means to understand. In the same way, when the light of revelation is directed within, it evolves our understanding to the point where it can give rise to the desire to understand desire itself. Being able to clearly differentiate between our wants and needs through the understanding of the nature of desire leads to growing and evolving spiritually. On the other hand, when the light of attention is directed externally, our inner light only reveals to us what we want to have and experience in the world. We are not concerned in the least with understanding the facility of desire because we're so caught up with what we're lacking, how much we have, or how much more we want. The truth is that, as soon as one desire is satisfied, another ultimately rises up to take its place. However, we also remain oblivious to this phenomenon so long as our attention is focused externally. When we have a healthy and sustainable outlet for our desires, we feel satisfied and experience temporary fulfillment, happiness, or even joy. The accomplishment of satisfying our desires leads us to a desireless state, a state of being where we're no longer concerned about achieving a goal or arriving at some state of being that we find more enjoyable than the present. In rare cases, this sense of fulfillment may even be experienced as bliss or euphoria. This feeling, once experienced, burns deep in our memories and becomes a craving, something that is constantly sought out by following the same processes we think brought it on in the first place. However, when we find that no matter what we do, we can't quite recapture that feeling we know for certain exists, we begin to experience the opposite end of the spectrum: frustration, impatience, anger, suffering, and even physical pain. When we find ourselves in a world full of limitations and obstacles that prevent us from fulfilling our desires, we want nothing more than for these restrictions to be eliminated. What we truly want is absolute freedom, autonomy, choice, and the means to choose. But rather than looking within and investigating a path to the desired end state that way, we look to change the world and others instead. That is, we temporarily put aside what we actually want, identify the barriers of understanding between us and it, and try to remove them through external efforts, oftentimes leading to failure, hopelessness, and regret. These feelings also burn deep, and having experienced them, we naturally never want to experience them again. That is, our primary desire becomes the prevention of experiencing any pain and suffering, followed by the secondary desire of recapturing that state of pleasure, bliss, euphoria, and happiness. To see this clearly is to see that every waking second is devoted to either the aversion of pain or the pursuit for pleasure. However, to look even deeper is to see that both the aversion of pain and the pursuit of pleasure are two sides of the same coin. A desire to move towards pleasure means to naturally move away from pain, and resisting the movement towards pain is to either move towards pleasure or remain in a more favorable state than pain. Understanding this base layer facility clearly and the way it operates within us leads to certain revelations a layer higher. We begin to see that even when we manage to recapture that state of joy, it doesn't last long because our primary desire is constantly at work, even if there's nothing to be concerned with. Thus, even in the state of euphoria or bliss, It calls out at us and interrupts our experience to tell us the truth which we know full well. This will not last, and rather than continue to waste our time dwelling in and enjoying the experience, we instead move towards figuring out how to sustain it permanently, and as a consequence, are catapulted out of that state of pleasure with a goal for the future. That is, we become our own biggest limitation and obstacle to both finding and maintaining joy in the present. As we've previously come to understand, the mind is a problem solver that must address and solve the desires and needs that arise. Also, the mind cannot differentiate between wants and needs. There's either a problem there that needs a solution or there's not. Whether you have the problem of finding your next meal, getting that brand new sports car, or even finding God, for the mind, they are identical at the base layer. The solutions it seeks represents the temporary cessation of the base layer desire to find happiness, because this is what we dedicate every waking second of our life to, finding and maintaining happiness, and in the process, avoiding pain. Though problems may vary in complexity, it should be clear that the same mind is responsible for solving them. However, the desire for the complete annihilation of pain and suffering, as well as the desire for permanent happiness, represent a class of problem that can keep the mind occupied for life. This is the primary problem that actually exists within all, and consequently it is also the birthplace of greed. That is, though desires may differ on the surface, I want a car, I want a house, I want fame and fortune, I want a family, I want wealth, I want power, or I want God, the mind is only concerned with solving the underlying primary problem of permanence, and whatever problem it comes across is nothing but another obstacle that gets it closer to finally achieving that. A spiritual seeker's job is to first of all confirm that it is so within themselves, and secondly, to determine whether or not this is a realistic expectation for the future. That is, can the desire to be permanently free of pain and find permanent happiness actually be a problem that has a definitive solution or a goal that can be realistically achieved? It is through this lens that we shall investigate the seventh parable of the Master, the Rich Fool. The Gospel, according to St. Luke, verse 12:15 through 12:21. Then he said to them, "Watch out! Be on your guard against all kinds of greed. A man's life does not consist in the abundance of his possessions." And he told them this parable. The ground of a certain rich man produced a good crop. He thought to himself, "What shall I do? I have no place to store my crops." Then he said, "This is what I'll do. I will tear down my barns and build bigger ones. And there I will store all my grain and all my goods. And I'll say to myself, 'You have plenty of good things laid up for many years. Take life easy. Eat, drink, and be merry.' But God said to him, 'You fool. This very night your life will be demanded from you. Then who will get what you have prepared for yourself?' This is how it will be with anyone who stores up things for himself, but is not rich towards God." We are beings who use the knowledge of the past to help us navigate the world in the present, as we strive to move towards some hypothetical and brighter future. Since we've spoken at great length about fear in these lectures, it is only fitting to begin the analysis of this parable with fear. Fear arises when memories or familiar situations that have brought us pain in the past reemerge in the present. However, fear and anxiety can also arise in anticipation of a threat. When we foresee a potential future outcome that may yield pain, we mobilize to neutralize and avoid that pain at all cost. But the reality is that nobody can foresee the future, and the pain that may befall us due to various life situations or extraordinary circumstances. The threats we can foresee and try our best to avoid are likely a tiny fraction of what's actually possible. Yet we strive regardless to prevent anything and everything that is within our power to prevent, just to avoid subjecting ourselves to that pain. Being cautious and defensive, always on guard in anticipation of a threat, no matter how big or small, leads to nothing but agony. From the fear of what we may say in the heat of a moment to a loved one, to an altercation that may arise out of nowhere with a complete stranger, to the uncertainty of making ends meet and providing for our families, being anxious for the future robs us of our present. Even if the threat is a complete illusion that will likely never manifest, it doesn't stop us from preparing for the worst. We can't relax because the past constantly reminds us of what's possible, and that brings fear because we don't want to experience being hurt again, physically, emotionally, or psychologically. Thus, a separation emerges between self and world, as well as self and other. Behind this barrier, there's some security because externally, the barrier helps us show an image of courage, confidence, and a host of false virtues that serve no other purpose than to protect that fragile entity cowering within. This defensive structure is known as the ego, and its purpose is to protect. In the spiritual search, we hear about all types of processes and procedures that lead one to ego death or killing off the ego. However, this structure can only exist if there is fear, and so long as we engage in anything that serves to annihilate a structure that serves to protect us, we only succeed at generating more fear and consequently strengthening the very thing we're looking to dissolve. In short, this is the wrong approach. Instead, we should be approaching through questioning that fear and determining if it is valid. Structures that defend are no longer necessary when there's no longer a threat, but first, we must ensure that there really are no threats. In the parable, we're introduced to a rich man who's been blessed with wealth, security, and opportunity. Yet he's still afraid, planning and plotting for the future. He's more concerned about hoarding what he has for the inevitable rainy day ahead than giving thanks and rejoicing in the moment. The real tragedy that plagues us is precisely this, postponing and deferring our happiness to the future. Just as the rich man contemplates and stresses about how he will store the fruits of his labor, we also do the same without realizing it. Our blessings always seem to go unnoticed, and we take them for granted until something happens that reminds us how fragile and short life really is. If our eyes were open and we clearly seen the impossibility of the miracle that is creation, we would gasp in wonderment and amazement. If our eyes were truly open and we'd recognize just how precious our time here is, we wouldn't defer or postpone anything for the future, but rather, we'd live every day like it was our last. The rich amongst us are no exception. Just like the rest of us, they're anxious about how to acquire even more and how to avoid losing what they have. Suppose we wanted the experience of visiting another country. We crunched the numbers and told ourselves that we could make it work if we saved a certain amount of money each month. We also proceeded to plan every detail of that trip and work hard to acquire what we needed to make it a reality. However, when the time finally came to go and satisfy our inner desire, to live life and make our dream a reality, fear crept in to remind us of the inevitable risks of spending that money. What if we got sick? What if we lost our jobs? Or what if something happened to us in a foreign land? Every excuse under the sun seems to arise just to keep us from realizing our desires. When the dream is on the verge of becoming real, the fear manufactures excuses to prevent us from making it true and instead dreams up something grander, or projects it into the future, giving us something new to chase and occupy ourselves with. Wait till next year when the money doubles. Wait and see what we will own. Wait and see what we will drive. Wait and see how others will look at us and admire us. However, next year turns into the next and into the next until we forget how to dream, and we forget how to live, because the only thing that seems to bring us any satisfaction at all is seeing a number increasing in our online portfolio. Right in the middle of our admiration of that stockpile that always seems to fill us up with pride, we suddenly and unexpectedly realize that we traded our dreams, our spark, our vitality, our youth, and our precious time here for this hollow feeling, having never truly questioned, learned, lived, or did something that truly mattered. We're on a conveyor belt like the generations that came and went before us and gave us the blueprint for how to live. Having constantly put life off until tomorrow, we can only observe as that conveyor belt edges ever closer toward the end. It is only then that we suddenly realize that we cheated ourselves. Money is a technology, a manufacturer's store of energy, or an IOU that can be exchanged for real energy. The real energy we spend working is rewarded back to us in the form of these notes that can be exchanged for real energy at a later time. It differs from its predecessor, trade, in that money provides one with choice. For example, money may be exchanged for food, shelter, clothing, transportation, or investments that lead to acquiring more. In the case where money is exchanged for food, Food is broken down by the body to extract real energy. That energy is used to live and to work in order to acquire more and so on. Thus, the way this energy is acquired and released has a cyclical quality to it and must be kept moving. When we want to take that trip, the money is exchanged not only for the energy it takes to get us there, but the experience itself re-energizes us in other ways. That is, to satisfy one curiosity or to make one dream come true means to make room for the next ones to arise and to take their place, to cycle through and be released. Our desires are a form of energy that must be released in order for something new to emerge within. When desires are satisfied, it leads to temporary contentment, fulfillment, and happiness. That energy that's been nagging at us, causing us to plan and strategize to achieve our goals, does it all so that the problem can be solved. When that experience comes to pass, it leaves us in a temporary state of silence and rest, and that alone is the only reward of some significance. That state is where the euphoria is. It is where the bliss is. It is the experience of being replenished with new energy that hasn't yet begun the process of transforming into a desire and consequently seeking an avenue or strategy for release. That sense of achievement comes from ridding ourselves of the pressure and frankly the burden of having to realize that dream. Despite the various obstacles that existed in our way, we overcame and achieved and earned the reward of fulfillment and rest. To have ridden ourselves of this stagnated energy that nagged at us for so long and moved us into action is what actually brings the contentment, and not the object we finally found a way to acquire or that place we finally managed to visit. That's what desire is. It is a knot in the mind, a cluster of energy that needs to be untangled and released despite the limitations and obstacles that exist in the world and within us that prevent them from being released. Desires appear to be on a never-ending conveyor belt. When they are not satisfied, when they're put off, when we can't seem to find an outlet for this energy through either fulfillment, actualization, or manifestation, then they start to back up and become stagnant and dense, which leads us to a state of pain. This pain can be experienced psychologically in the form of stress, anxiety, or depression, and it may be experienced physically in the form of muscle aches, joint aches, lower back pain, or even dehydration and malnutrition. At least some of the ailments we experience are caused by this trapped energy, by something we want but can't have. This is what eventually leads to the desire for escape, because that desire is very easily satisfied. We only need to pop a pill, have a drink or a smoke, eat something decadent, engage in sexual activities, or scroll for hours on end to temporarily suspend desire. These activities work because they are effective at temporarily releasing our burden by instantly catapulting us into a state of pleasure or relaxation, leaving the world of desire behind, and for however briefly, communing with the present. However, these pleasures are not free, and when abused or performed in excess, come with a heavy price, as these temporary escapes are detrimental to one's well-being, both physically and psychologically. Consider what happens when we take in energy in the form of food. When used up to work or exercise, the energy released is eventually replenished with new. However, when we take in energy from food without an outlet, such as in the case of stress eating or eating for the pleasure aspect of it alone, the body stores it up. Irrespective of whether there's actually scarcity versus abundance out there, the body behaves the same way and hoards whatever it receives in excess. As a result, we become physically dense, which is an outer manifestation of the desire to constantly escape a state of discomfort through the comfort and pleasures brought on by eating. So long as excess energy from food is stored away and not released, its own density starts to ensure that it cannot be easily released. The only way the desire to avert pain and find pleasure can be satisfied is through eating, which is what leads to weight gain, and the heavier we get, the more energy is required to support us, and thus, the more we must inevitably eat. We find that we no longer eat for the pleasure of it alone, but also out of the necessity to avoid certain pain. There's multiple ways to lose weight or this excess energy, either by reducing or eliminating our food intake for some time, or using the energy up through exercising. These methods, or a combination of them, effectively introduce an outlet for the excess energy. However, Doing either or causes us to face the pain that we've been avoiding and escaping through eating. If we are firm and determined, we will succeed. If we are not, then we will fail to fulfill our desire. This determination is clearly an attempt at mind over matter, but it should be clear that the greed for more pleasure is ultimately what led us to a state of pain. That is, our inner light reveals to us the contradiction that although there is instant gratification brought on by the food, the pleasure of overeating is not worth the inevitable pain it leads us to. Though we enjoy the taste, we don't like the way we look, and more importantly, we don't like the way we feel. We don't like the health risks we have subjected ourselves to, and these are generally the reasons we opt for change. However, few are able to stay disciplined to achieve and maintain their objectives. The truth is that the pain associated with breaking an addiction has to also burn deep and has to be experienced multiple times, generally through gut-wrenching and heart-breaking relapses, for one to see the true power of our desires for pleasure. We are willing to subject ourselves to certain pain if it means experiencing that pleasure first. Thus, just as the memory of the pleasure burns deep, the memory of the pain must burn even deeper for a shift to finally be possible. That is, having seen and experienced the cycle of pleasure and pain again and again, at some point we must say enough is enough and stand firm in our conviction to maintain dominance over our own natural urges and instincts to satisfy the very desire that seems to cause us pain. The shortest path to a better state of being or a healthier state of being must pass through physical, psychological, or emotional pain. However, when we face that pain and endure it, we learn from it and we come to understand that just like pleasure, it too is temporary and something that can be withstood and overcome instead of constantly avoided and escaped. To gain strength from the truth that the inner light reveals and to live life according to that despite how difficult or uncomfortable it may be is what true power really is. Just as food is necessary to sustain our bodies, desires are necessary to sustain our minds. The mind manufactures desires to constantly ensure we have a problem to solve or a goal to strive towards. This keeps us busy, moving, or occupied in order to constantly have an outlet to release that energy. Money can certainly satisfy our necessities, food, water, shelter, and clothing. In our society, however, money is also necessary to satisfy desire to a great extent. Clearly, not all desires can be satisfied with money, such as the desire to know, because no one can buy the answers to the secrets of creation or the genesis of life, for example. Thus, when the mind manufactures desires that can be satisfied with money, spirit is starved. Spirit is satisfied only when mind and body are both satisfied. But because the mind, in its endless pursuit for permanence, can only be satisfied temporarily, and usually, if not always, at the expense of the body, then desire ensures that spirit can never be satisfied. The search is about using the inner light to reveal the truth about desire and to determine whether something exists that can satisfy the spirit through the mutual satisfaction of both mind and body. That is, when the mind starts to manufacture desires that cannot be satisfied easily through money, the mind must work tirelessly to satisfy these desires through other means, but predominantly ways that require thinking. Through constantly failing to satisfy its ambitions and desires, the mind will begin to eventually direct its attention closer to home and hopefully see the impact of its endless pursuit for pleasure on the body. The shift that generally occurs in light of this revelation is that the mind begins to give rise to desires that are in service to the body and not at the expense or detrimental to the body. This shift represents, at the very least, the potential to satisfy spirit. Greed is caused by the unquenchable desire for more because the greedy can't find contentment despite having their necessities met and pleasure satisfied. There's no contentment in having security, wealth, and luxuries once we have it. Rather, it is taken for granted. Something must certainly be lacking. Otherwise, one would think the pursuit for more would end. What about power? Would that continue to bring pleasure and satisfy? Can one truly have enough power? It is uncertain. However, what is certain is that what we mistake for power isn't real power. Let's suppose money and wealth weren't a factor. Let's assume that we had unlimited wealth to extrapolate the trajectory of our desire. One would think that there is such a thing as enough, and there is such a thing as contentment, but it just isn't so. Rather, the desire takes on another form but continues to be nonetheless. Money can certainly buy security and satisfy our craving for things. However, as desires of all sorts arise and are satisfied through our hypothetical and unlimited means, we begin to desire what we mistake for power. Recall that real power is the strength and courage to live life according to the truth revealed to us by our own inner light, despite how difficult or uncomfortable it may be to do so. What we mistake for power, on the other hand, is the objectification of living beings and utilizing them to satisfy desires that can no longer be quenched through materialism. Though the search for power may appear to be different than the search to be free of fear and the search for material gain, it is only a continuation of these and nothing new. Pleasure must be experienced, and when materialism no longer satisfies, pleasure can only arise from feeling competent and worthy. It may arise from the admirations others have of us, or strangely enough, through their envy or jealousy of us. That is, we find it pleasurable when others want to or try to be like us. The saying, "imitation is the sincerest form of flattery," is quite fitting here. Pleasure also comes from being recognized, valued, and praised. And though there's nothing wrong with any of these desires necessarily, the thirst for more admiration leads to seeking idolization or glorification, and from there has the potential to transform into greed. That is, where once we enjoy the occasional compliment, in greed we begin to crave it and live for that external praise and validation. When desire turns to greed, that unquenchable thirst for more, nothing can fill the void, and in that state of frustration or desperation, we may find ourselves engaging in less than noble or downright immoral acts just to satisfy our endless desire for more. Greed is what fuels the desire to want to rise above others and compete, oppress, and in radical cases, even enslave. So long as our inner light of revelation is directed outwards, this naturally goes on unnoticed. We only see ourselves doing what we must in a world where everybody else seems to be doing the same, trying and striving for greater heights. We're completely immersed in the race and seem to only find temporary satisfaction in the hollow promises of getting ahead, recognition, or praise. The more we think we're valued, the harder we run and the more energy we exert trying desperately to rise and outdo those pitted against us. Peace is a desire pushed out somewhere in the distant future because now is the time to run. It is the time to strive and to struggle so that one day we might acquire that permanent satisfaction of having security, the best of things, and of course respect, admiration, and even the envy of others. The whole thing resembles a giant pyramid. At the base, we have the fearful amongst us, the meek, the ones living in poverty that don't have the will, the means, or the strength to rise. They're concerned about their next meal and not about worldly luxuries and riches. They find contentment and pleasure from the simple things, or rather the things that don't represent any obstacles the likes of which one finds higher up in the climb. This layer is all about survival, and if that's taken care of, desire moves one towards escaping from the hardships through pleasures by any means available. Great are the obstacles constructed to contain this base layer, the foundation of the pyramid, the ones who are responsible for shouldering the weight of it all. The base tends to the necessities turned luxuries for the ones higher up. They cook their meals, transport their goods, haul their trash, walk their dogs, clean their yards, pools, and cars. They do the thankless jobs nobody wants and collect the lowest wages, basically ensuring they live and die in poverty. Although it is technically possible to rise out of this base layer in a capitalistic society, it has become increasingly more difficult to do so with hard work alone. At the very minimum, it requires some luck, opportunity, or support. The base layer also serves as a stark reminder to the climbers of what it can mean to fall. That is, what the base layer represents. It represents the incentive to rise higher, fueled by the fear of falling. It is what keeps us holding on to the structure and the rules, climbing and seeking. It is what gets us to copy what others around us are doing and what others who came before us did. The social programming passed forward through generations immemorial shouts at us to give ourselves and our evolutionary branch a chance and to climb or be trampled down there and be just another face, just another insignificant brick in the structure. It shouts at us to be extraordinary, to fight hard and rise to reach the apex, the point where there is nobody else above us, the point where there are unlimited degrees of freedom, the point where desires can rise and fall seamlessly, the point where we can eat, drink, and be merry. The higher up we rise, as in the case of the middle layer, we certainly do have the means to find contentment, given all that we've been blessed with and worked hard to acquire. We may certainly accept our role in society and find peace in our desire to rise was genuinely gone. Like a brick that's no longer concerned with rising or falling, but nevertheless supports the weight above it and is supported by the foundation below it, we could allow ourselves to find some stability for the remainder of our days, because in our genuine contentment, the desire to compete and to climb has been extinguished. We tell ourselves that we're content, but we really aren't. We tell ourselves to focus on our kids, on our families, on being good role models and good citizens. We tell ourselves anything we have to in order to keep taking that train into work every morning and being a doormat for our bosses. We seem to be living for those 2 days a week where we finally get an hour to escape into our addiction of choice. The truth is simple, but hard to admit and even harder to swallow. We live and work for that check every week and an all-inclusive trip once a year due to our own limitations to rise higher and our refusal to fall lower. In living for tomorrow, we've sold our souls for the comforts and security of being just another brick required to support and sustain that structure. We tell ourselves we no longer want to rise or to compete, but that is a lie. The truth is that we don't have what it takes to compete, and we know it. We don't have what it takes to rise at the expense of having to trample over others. We don't have what it takes to objectify others and use them as footstools to attain greater heights. We also don't have what it takes to sustain and defend those heights through the constant combat it demands from others trying to knock us down or the ones looking to climb higher. That is the truth. That climb up higher is reserved for a different kind of individual, while we do and tell ourselves whatever we must to avoid the agony of being reduced to a mere brick. Such is the nature of our limitations and our inability to overcome the obstacles that are necessary in order for us to rise. We need to lie and deceive to rise in this world. We need to cheat, we need to steal, and we need to take credit for the hard work of others. We need to be seen and we need to be recognized. We need to manipulate and oppress because that is how the system is constructed. That is the only way to get higher. We must leave honor and dignity below or move over to the role of brick. We also need to make alliances with others who are also looking to rise. However, just as there can be no honor amongst thieves, these alliances we forge in order to rise higher are not founded in trust because there can be no trust in competition. Rather, they are founded on mutual interests. You help me here, I'll help you there. You give me a boost now, I'll pull you up when I get there later. And though one can certainly argue that it takes some element of trust to form these alliances, it is clear that this trust is founded in reluctance and desperation rather than willingness and honor. If we know nothing else about corporate America and American politics, knowing that it is mostly about making false promises and dangling them over the ones looking to rise would lead to understanding the majority of it. The system continues to function because it is too big to fail, and absolutely everyone is integrated whether they want to or not. They say the American dream is dead, but what is alive and well is the reluctant trust we put in the system, in our state of desperation, being hopelessly dependent on it. This society forces us to climb by first ensuring we are in debt. We must work to pay off what we owe, or be dropped into the very pits we know full well exist. Even if we are debt-free and can afford not to work, health insurance, healthcare, and taxes are so incredibly expensive that they quickly deplete our savings. We're forced back into the structure for either the incentives of health insurance or to avoid going broke by electing not to participate. The alliances created by insurance companies, healthcare providers, and corporations are just one of the many perverse ways that the top layers exert pressure and dominance over the lower layers. By offering significant monthly discounts for outrageous healthcare and pharmaceutical costs, leaving one little choice but to play the role required of them or risk getting sick without coverage. Despite this, however, capitalism remains the best we can do given everything we've tried to either construct or sustain the socio-economical and political structure throughout the ages. In the case of making false promises,
It is easy to see that there are many individuals looking to rise, but only one promotion or only one donation, and the one who rises above the others or defends the interests of the promoter gets it. Though there's nothing wrong with providing an incentive to drive healthy competition in order to choose the best candidate for the job, there is a major problem with promoting unity, brotherhood, and teamwork while simultaneously engaging in divisive policies and practices that basically ensure that only the one who can slit the most throats in the stealthiest manner can rise. But that isn't enough. They must also do it under the guise of honor and integrity. They must behave diplomatically and admirably, and if they can somehow do all that while finding a way to also promote unity, that individual is destined to rise to great heights. They claim it's all about the abilities and the skills publicly. It isn't. It's all about the ambition. It's all about who can make the most false promises so that when the time comes, they'll be able to dangle the same false promises over the new batch of climbers looking to rise up. This maintains the status quo and ensures that with every passing generation, this process is perfected to cement the structure permanently, thereby protecting the interests of the ones at the top at the continued expense of all those below and not merely the ones at the base. But that is what we're taught to want. We're taught that money brings security, material gain, opportunity, and power, which are necessary to find happiness. This isn't far from the truth, but what we aren't taught is that any purity within us and any desire to accomplish something noble to change the world and the structure of greed, lies, and deceit will be snatched from us the moment we start climbing and are forced to compete in order to fulfill our mere necessities, let alone our dreams. Most people don't see the entirety of the structure. They're too busy trying to get a firm grip to avoid the fall or looking for a quick boost to get a bit higher. They simply do what they must until one of three things happens. They transition into a brick at some layer or another, they rise high enough to see that there's no apex in sight, or they fall. What about the very top? What about the elites? The ones who no longer have the fear of falling because they've leveraged technology to effectively give themselves wings. Though we're not interested in conspiracy theories of who runs the world or why, having seen firsthand what it takes to rise in that absolute dogpile, we're naturally curious about the top. Though we'll never be there ourselves to witness it, can we at least imagine for a moment what it would be like? Through this thought experiment, we can see the relativistic nature of desire. We might want that mansion, that yacht, the Bentley with the driver, private tennis lessons, traveling the world and eating lobster or whatever else we associate with being rich. But those relative desires for things blind us from the fact that at those layers, these individuals are no longer driven by the desire for things. Despite not knowing what desires drive them because they are relative, we can be sure that just like us, it is desire that drives them nonetheless. Having never been in that position, it isn't fair to speculate, but it doesn't take a lot to see that if we were at that position ourselves, we'd want nothing else than to remain there. The desire to do anything necessary to attain or maintain that top position of power, that title, that respect or admiration, that idolization or glorification, is to see the pinnacle of our own greed. That which is not relative, but absolute, irrespective of what level of the structure we find ourselves at. The desire to dominate and the thirst for power is something that can't be quenched because even if one was at the very top, all alone, having conquered the entire earth, they'd still know and have to face their own mortality. The higher we climb in the realm of men, the more evident the greatness and the glory of God becomes. Unless we can humble ourselves and bow down before that mystery and glory, then our own greed, the thirst for even more when no more is possible, will engulf us in evil and completely consume us. However, having turned their backs on God and having conquered the realm of men, one of the ways the desire for dominance is satisfied is through perversion. The thirst for dominance over innocence is real, and there is evidence of it, such as in the case in the laundry list of pedophiles who visited Epstein's Island. If one valued innocence, they wouldn't be caught dead in a place like that, or in the company of a man like that. But the truth is that wherever there is a demand, a supply naturally emerges, while the opposite may not necessarily hold true. The deflection we all publicly witnessed was evident. Within a week or so, that list was somehow, someway buried and swept under the rug. Nobody on that list was questioned or gave an account of just what they were doing there. Instead, their supplier took the fall and, conveniently enough, his own life, while those whom he supplied now hold public lectures about the importance of defending innocence. The structure of this pyramid may be full of bricks, but bricks became bricks primarily because they chose morality, while the immoral find ways to rise through the shadows of deceit without being exposed. They find ways to satisfy their perverted desires over others without consequences because of the heights they've elevated themselves to. They very simply have a safety net of wealth and lawyers that ensure they remain in power and no longer experience the fear of falling. What could someone possibly want who has experienced everything there is to experience? What could they possibly still desire? Well, I would argue that they would still have the burning desire to know the truth, the mystery of creation, and our place in it. However, this may also be relativistic, and it may be the case that someone who has everything couldn't care less about this question, because if they did, they would have spent more time rising in the realm of spirit than in the realm of men. Perhaps they simply want to be king of the world and be glorified by all. Perhaps they want to be looked up to as saviors or to overlook that very pyramid they conquered in triumph. Some may wholeheartedly believe that it is their destiny and divine mission to save humanity, or are somehow divine themselves. In short, they may want the qualities we most associate with God, all-powerful, all-knowing, and immortal, within the grand contradiction that they achieve great heights through the qualities we most associate with Satan, manipulation, deceit, and disregard for innocence. The entire thing becomes a subjective exercise for the spiritual seeker, an opportunity to truly question their place in the world and discover what they really want. Despite our desires or ambitions or anything having to do with the search, it is the moral obligation of humanity, irrespective of status or class, rich and poor, weak and powerful alike, to defend innocence, to defend and fight for that which can't fight for itself. When we fail at that, or look the other way at that, or find legal loopholes to protect predators from that, when we aren't willing to die to defend that, then the soul of man is lost. Evil has engulfed the earth, and God has turned his back on us. Regarding the nature of desire and addiction, St. Paul the Apostle said, "All things are lawful, but I will not be put under the power of anything." The goal, according to Paul, is to witness the power desire has over ourselves and to become more powerful than that. However, in order to first see, one must allow desire and even greed to manifest and run their natural course. Just as with everything else we've studied about, the power of the inner light of attention is about using it to see clearly whatever is revealed to us without any interference that can alter its true nature and thereby yield a contamination of truth. Desire after desire, dream after dream hold the exact same pattern and follow the exact same process. There's a want, there's effort towards satisfying that want, there's either success or failure in satisfying the want, and finally, there's either pleasure or pain as a result of the outcome. After clearly seeing this pattern repeating endlessly, we naturally begin to question this facility, knowing full well the outcomes that will arise. And though the desire or dreams may differ from one to the next, the underlying problem and processes do not. The moment we can question the desire when it arises and ask, what is the point of pursuing that temporary pleasure? What is the point of wanting to be seen by others in a certain way versus another? Or flat out, just what is the point? It is at that moment that we've touched upon something tangible, meaningful, and real. To come to the understanding that the cyclical nature of desire can only lead to more worldly desires that can at best get us to the top of that pyramid, but nevertheless fail to capture the permanence we seek, one aspires for something a lot more profound than the hollow feeling of this so-called power. To trace the cycle all the way back to the genesis of the emerging desire is to question why we want something temporary when we're clearly after permanence. To first question means to be aware and not be animated blindly by desire like a puppet, automatically exerting effort without understanding why. The truth is that we've been taught to want everything we desire, including the desire to know God and what has been defined to us as God. Is there a desire that is truly our own, and originated within us? Is there one thing we can aspire to know, to have, or to experience that was not given to us externally? The great spiritual teacher, U.G. Krishnamurti, used to say that all questions arise out of the answers we already have. Perhaps that's what it means to figure out what the unknown, the mystery, and this inner light that dwells within really is. The questions remain because the answers we've been given are not the truth. Perhaps that light, which has the power to witness even desire itself, and conclude with absolute certainty that they do not belong to it, is worth investigating and understanding. Having seen the full cycle of desire from that perspective, the greatest desire one ultimately comes to have is to be free of desire itself and not to trample over others en route to some illusory world heights to proclaim or be proclaimed as something or other. Freedom from desire represents the breaking of the predictable cycle and represents an avenue towards novelty and experiencing something real and spontaneous. But to the mind, of course, the desire to be free of desire is also just another problem that needs solving. For how can we possibly rid ourselves of the very thing that keeps us occupied? That is, this desire is clearly part of the same cycle of permanence that can only lead us to self-deception and to claiming we're actually achieved our goal simply because we start to desire more noble things, or because we've chosen to shut down, strangle, or control the facility of desire to the point of living in complete agony. However, we fail to see the irony that the desire to control desire remains a desire that ensures we can never break free of it. When we finally come to see the truth that there is nothing we can do to suppress desire or thought through the facility of control, and that no matter what we do, we cannot be free of desire, then the conclusion that naturally emerges is that desire is necessary to our experience. However, it does not belong to us in any way, shape, or form. They arise and they are seen. There's effort and it is seen. There's struggle and it is seen. There are goals, successes, failures, highs, lows, and they are all seen. But the facility that witnesses, our inner light, is completely divorced from the entirety of that cycle. Even the knowing of what is likely to happen when a particular cycle arises does not belong to the light of consciousness, as it serves to simply reveal that and nothing more. To truly be free of desire doesn't mean to suppress control or deflect desire. Rather, it means to stop taking ownership of them. If it came from out there, from the world, or from society, then just let it find the best avenue for release on its own. But if your light is shining on the desire itself, as opposed to illuminating the way for that to find release through complex and elaborate methods, then they begin to find a natural rhythm of cycles that can easily rise and fall, leaving one in a state of contentment. What does this mean? It means that the mind naturally starts to abort unrealistic desires that are grandiose, ambitious, or greedy, and gravitates towards the greed of becoming more simplified. Reducing effort is the key, and having micro goals closer to the present is how we gravitate closer and closer to the light of self and the light of permanence. We don't need to experience the pleasure found at the tip of that pyramid to know that it will not last, just as we don't need to experience constant dread and agony to know that it will also not last. To allow the mind to do what the mind does based on what it has been revealed to it by the inner light takes power. Acceptance, release, and surrender take power and bring the power necessary to allow our minds to find a rhythm and an orbit around the light of self, around spirit. Desires will continue to be there so long as there is a pulse. Effort will be there. Doing will be there. Achievements and failures will also be there, but none of it is us or belongs to us. With this revelation, we're simply free to watch the show. There will be moments when we're pulled back into the show instead of the theater and experience that pain, suffering, agony, guilt, or pleasure, and even fulfillment as our own. But once we've managed to see our real nature, however briefly, as simply the witness, it cannot be forgotten or unseen. Thus, one tends to gravitate more towards God, the light of truth itself, rather than the show or the character. This is what it means to be rich towards God. This character once had certain expectations and suffered from a laundry list of desires so incredibly complex, ambitious, and naive that they brought nothing but ailments to its state of being and others around him. But over time and through the path of truth, the natural detachment exposes everything and shows the character the difference between right and wrong and how what's going on screen is responsible for the pain it's experiencing. Imagine if we could watch a recording of a year of our life through a screen without a vested interest of coming out on top, succeeding, failing, finding pleasure, or finding joy. Suppose that neither the pain nor the suffering did anything for us, being merely a witness of the happening. How would we grow? What would we learn? What would we see that truly mattered or lasted? Our hopes and dreams, our goals, our future desires and aspirations are the treasures we have prepared for ourselves and stored in the barns of our minds. All that we consider to be our ticket to happiness, to eat, drink, and be merry, is the very fuel that powers the never-ending facility of desire. All the while, we fail to see that the body is on its own trajectory, towards its inevitable end, along with the rest of nature. Nothing in the universe cares about our needs or desires. They simply flow towards whatever direction they've been propelled. They find natural rhythms and orbits with their dependencies and dwell there, satisfying their basic needs and simple desires as they arise. However, the sheer complexity of our mind has elevated basic needs to the level of grand goals and expectations that require a lot of energy to be satisfied and sustained. The greater the task or the greater the accomplishment, the greater the reward, but it never lasts because the facility of desire can never be fully satisfied. There's always something bigger, something grander, or something a lot more intricate and complex. There's always something worth conquering that we think will bring us an even bigger sense of accomplishment and pleasure, virtually ensuring that we never find peace and contentment. The path must first lead us towards understanding this truth, and the inner light must first reveal to us clearly how the facility of desire works. Only then can we acquire the understanding that nothing can be done to extinguish it or destroy it. We must also learn that the key to the very permanence we seek is through simplicity and not complexity. It is only through simplifying our lives that desires can rise and fall naturally, yielding a constant stream of micro-pleasures that translate into permanent happiness. That is, rather than having one grand goal that will bring us a massive reward worth 100 units of pleasure at the cost of enduring absolute misery until we acquire it, what if in our simplified state of being we had 100 micro-goals worth only one unit of pleasure each, but it meant avoiding that misery associated with waiting for the end state or that massive reward? Would that be a worthy trade? The truth is that it is so regardless with any goal. The only difference is the lens or the perspective we're choosing to observe the happening through. What are the simple things that we can learn to find enjoyable when the grand ambitions of understanding reality, creation, mortality, desires, aliens, or God comes to an end? What is there when the mind no longer considers these questions as problems and loses all interest in these speculations, theories, and ideas? Simplicity and morality remain. Love for self and love for other equally, and love and acceptance for all the creation exactly as it is remains. These are the true gifts the real God has provided to each of us, irrespective of what perverse hierarchical power structures or social classes we have given rise to. That one at the base can find joy just like the one at the top of the pyramid, relative to their simplicity of their own desires and the simplicity of having the means to satisfy those desires. When the facility of desire operates this way, it may as well not even be. Everything is so simple that the mind can solve any problem that arises or attain whatever it wants with minimal effort, the same way it can direct the body subconsciously to go get some water when it feels thirst. This leaves the light of consciousness free to simply be, to simply shine without interfering in the affairs of the mind, the body, or in the affairs of the world. We may laugh or we may cry at what the light reveals. The being may rise or it may fall, but that light will always be, for we, each of us, are categorically that light. Thank you for your attention, and may God bless you.